You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Advances in the Delayed Onset of Type 1 Diabetes, Strategies to Improve Awareness and Care for the Practicing Clinician. I'm joined today by Dr. Sanjoy Dutta, the Chief Scientific Officer at Breakthrough T1D, formerly the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. He's going to take us through some of the exciting research going on in screening for type 1 diabetes, slowing its progression, and possibly one day preventing it. Welcome, Dr. Dutta.
Thank you for having me.
So the big deal in type 1 diabetes today is early diagnosis, even before the disease fully manifests. That requires screening. So can you talk a bit about that, why that is so important, how it's done, and what the research has shown?
Sure. Screening or early detection is very important for various reasons. I'll start with where we are today. Today, we are in a position to be able to identify these individuals by measuring a few proteins in the blood. They are called autoantibodies. It has been confirmed through years of research, decades of research, I would say, that the presence of one or more of these autoantibodies is a sign that your autoimmunity has already kicked in and you actually have type 1 diabetes. Maybe you're not insulin requiring it. So that can be done today. That is being done today, widespread even in the general population. But we are still working on enhancing methodologies to identify these individuals quickly in an inexpensive way and offer them options. So screening, that's where screening stands today. There are other advances in how to screen that we are now working. It's in research stage, such as the use of devices like continuous glucose monitors and others that can enhance the value on top of the autoantibodies I just mentioned.
Go a little bit more into that. How do you mean enhance the value?
Sure. So right now, the presence of two or more autoantibodies in the blood, or these are proteins measured in the blood, and signs of not being able to manage glucose, like after a meal, are signs that your disease is progressing well. Right now, we don't have a way to assess who will progress really fast in a matter of months, who will take 2 to 5 years, who will take 10 years. So we right now don't have a good tool to assess how fast a person will progress. What we know is the person will progress, but not how fast. If we add additional diagnostic or prognostic tools, such as a continuous glucose monitoring device and other measures that is now in R&D stage, we can increase what we call the positive predictive value, or the rate at which this person is going to require insulin. And this is very valuable to your other part of the question, why is screening so important today, if I can expand on that. Because by identifying these individuals, you're offering near-term and long-term benefits. Near-term, it has been shown that by identifying these individuals and providing them the clinical guidance, they're able to avoid a dangerous condition called diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, at diagnosis. This is a dangerous condition and in some cases leads to fatalities. And it has been shown that by proper early detection and clinical care support, you're able to reduce this significantly, right, from 50-60% down to below 5%. This is a near-term benefit one can realize. There are many long-term benefits, like cognitive behavioral development, like participating in clinical trials for therapies being developed, or even in the United States, we have an approved therapy now that delays the progression of type 1 diabetes insulin requiring by almost 3 years. So you can become eligible for this kind of a therapy that's approved and covered and in the market right now. So there are many advantages of screening. I touched upon a few near-term ones.
So we're going to talk about the long-term ones and the drug you mentioned, but let's go back to where the research is going in terms of devices. What would the CGM be measuring to add to the information you've received about the autoantibodies?
Great question. So the continuous glucose monitor, or the CGM, as the name suggests, it measures every few minutes your blood glucose levels and it reports out. So it is a very powerful tool in assessing in real time your ambient blood glucose levels, and if it's going up, going down. All of these are seen in people with type 1 diabetes even early on. And so as a result of which, let's say you consumed a meal, and a person without type 1 diabetes will be able to handle the meal really well because they have a pancreas that's making full amount of insulin and will keep the glucose levels within what we call a normal range. But in a person that's, even though they're not taking insulin but has autoantibodies, the blood markers, they have type 1 diabetes, you will see these disturbances in meals, in exercise, in all these things, glucose levels. And a CGM can detect it very early, and it's a powerful tool. And you don't have to wait for 6 months to go to a doctor's office and get a glucose tolerance test done, in which you consume a glucose-rich meal or a hemoglobin A1C, the gold standard marker, done. This can be done in real time, at home, and reported through the cloud. And that's one tool. There are other tools we're trying to develop to advance prognostication.
So what other devices are you looking at?
What we're trying to do, and this is all in R&D stage, as I mentioned here, there is many omic approaches, metabolomic, proteomic, and other approaches that are able to detect blood markers at much lower quantities than the autoantibodies, for example, that can be seen in people with early onset type 1 diabetes compared to people without type 1 diabetes. And these markers, when proven or when validated, can become a composite tool of prognostication. If I can humor you for a second with an analogy, in cardiovascular disease or imminent cardiovascular disease, you can have multiple markers measured. Inflammatory marker in your blood, cholesterol and other lipid levels in your blood, your blood pressure, the composite of all of these going in the wrong direction just increases your risk assessment for cardiovascular disease. Each marker has a value, but a combination of these markers, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And in type 1 diabetes, similarly, we can have a very powerful prognostication tool where the whole will be more than the sum of the parts, where the parts are autoantibodies, continuous glucose monitoring, other omic markers that are emerging to become valuable, so on and so forth. And we are working significantly on that. And the final thing, this will be very helpful for clinical implementation, is we're also trying to miniaturize these tests so that they can be done with very small amounts of blood, particularly in younger individuals like kids, as well as in point of care. So, of course, these tests have to be powerful, but they also have to be practical to be implemented. Cost practicality, deployment practicality, and that those are things that we are working on right now so that we can realize the dream of identifying individuals early on and intervening.
Wonderful. And you brought us right to the next question, which is intervention. As you said earlier, the FDA has approved the first drug ever shown to delay progression in type 1 diabetes, teplizumab. Tell us about that, and then we'd like to hear about what's coming down the pike.
So teplizumab, the drug that's been approved by the US FDA for intervention in what we call stage 2 type 1 diabetes. So these are individuals that have two or more autoantibodies and glucose imbalance or glucose intolerance, but are not insulin requiring it. If you can provide this monoclonal autoantibody, it's a one-time treatment of 14 days IV infusion, it's able to delay the onset of insulin requiring type 1 diabetes by a median of almost 3 years. And that means a lot. That means 3 years without type 1 diabetes, 3 years without the dangers of taking insulin, and 3 years is practically money in the bank where you have your own beta cells producing insulin and you can avoid many long-term complications, as has been shown in other studies that preceded teplizumab studies here. That was your first part of your question. What is exciting to us is now there is a first, it took a long time, but we have a first disease-modifying, disease-delaying therapy in the market now. And this just opens the door wide for many other therapies that are in early clinical development, phase 1, phase 2, and one even in phase 3 clinical development that is testing to see how you can modify. By modify, I mean slow down, halt, or ideally even reverse the course of the disease that has already started in an individual. And I would say there are about 8 to 10 of these therapies, in addition to teplizumab, that are in clinical testing in individuals of various age groups at the moment. We don't have the results yet from them, but the initial studies look promising.
Tell us about the one that's in phase 3.
So there is one particular therapy. There are actually two therapies in phase 3 being tested right now. They're both for what we call stage 3 diabetes. And stage 3 is where you've just been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. You've been put on insulin, but you have quite a significant amount of insulin production inside your body measured by a surrogate called C-peptide. So the two trials that are in phase 3 right now, one is called is actually using teplizumab here to see if you can prolong this initial period of not losing your beta cells, slow it down. And the other one is a trial of another antibody called the GAD65 antibody by, and that particular drug is called Diamet, like teplizumab. It's a different drug, but it's a different antibody. And these are being tested right now in phase 3 clinical testing in stage 3 type 1 diabetes. So This is advanced clinical testing, but in the stage 3 of type 1 diabetes. And there are several others that are in earlier stages, phase 2 and phase 1 of clinical testing in type 1 diabetes.
That's very exciting. I know that early results from the teplizumab being tested in patients with stage 3 did show an increase in C-peptide for longer. So that's exciting.
Exactly. And then there are other therapies that, to your question, Deb, there are other therapies that are called baricitinib or ATG, and some of these are actually therapies for approved for other indications. So they have a lot of safety information available, including in pediatric populations, that we see can be repurposed for type 1 diabetes. So we have a good starting point with these from a safety standpoint, but they have to be tested in type 1, of course.
Of course. Everyone talks about a cure. What is the reality of that in our lifetime?
Yeah, absolutely. I would first of all mention that it's cures. It's not cure. And this is a very important point to make. Type 1 diabetes, like most chronic non-communicable diseases, is also a very heterogeneous disease. It's heterogeneous in its genetics. It's heterogeneous in its presentation. It's heterogeneous in its clinical manifestation. So we anticipate that one cure is not going to be a panacea for all people with type 1 diabetes. It is foreseeable that there will be multiple cures. How is a cure defined? A cure is defined when you are diabetes free. That could imply you don't have to take your insulin shots or measure glucose levels or insulin independence. That's the holy grail that we are trying to achieve. It will come in iterations. Initially, it will come with significant reduction in insulin requirement, benefits against the extremes of glucose, hypo and hyperglycemia, delaying or prevention of complications because now you have good glucose control. And iteratively, it's going to improve towards removing the need for insulin totally, as well as providing glucose benefits and other metabolic benefits in the long term. There are other cures possible with approaches that actually modify the disease, just like we were talking about. So cures will be defined as what will it take to remove the clinical manifestation and the mental burden of type 1 diabetes, which is a 24/7, 365 disease. So we keep a broad definition for cures because it's going to be horses for courses at the end of the day.
That's great. How can doctors find clinical trials for their patients and encourage their patients to join these trials and to get screened?
Clinical trial execution, clinical trial acceleration is actually the Achilles heel of most diseases right now. It's finding the individuals, recruiting them, randomizing them, completing the trial. And some trials are quite onerous and time-taking. So it's a lot of burden on the individual, on the care team, and the clinical trial team. All said and done, the resources available right now, in addition to clinicaltrials.gov, which is a federal website that lists clinical trials in a searchable format, Breakthrough T1D has certain resources for type 1 diabetes. we have a partner, we have partnership there, which is a searchable matchmaking tool in a very simple, less than 60-second process to match you to your age, sex, geography, like 50-mile radius, 100-mile as you choose to be, and the therapy type that you are interested in. And it gives you options. And if you consent, it sends the information to the clinical trial coordinator to contact you with your consent. We are also we also have an army of volunteers and staff members that are doing clinical trial education to inform the community about the options they have. The decision to participate in clinical trial ultimately rests with the individual and their clinician. That's a decision that has to be made by an individual in consultation with their clinician and, of course, the caregiver family there. But we provide the resources for them to be armed to make that decision here. So those are some of the tools available. We're exploring additional tools such as a participant advisory council and other things. This includes people that have been there, done that, in 5 clinical trials, 10 clinical trials, 15 clinical trials, so they can speak to the experience of participating in a clinical trial and the benefit to risk profile of that participation.
That's an excellent answer. At this point, we have run out of time, sadly, but I want to thank you so much for that discussion. I really want to encourage people to go to the Breakthrough T1D website and learn more about the possibilities that are there. I want to thank our listeners for joining us, and I hope you'll listen to another episode from this series. We have 4 others. And let me tell you that this podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. In support of improving patient care, Med Learning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. I want to give a special thank you to our supporter, Sanofi US, who provided an educational grant for this activity.